the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
Kylie, David Bowie and Kate Bush's Running Up That Hill all sounds very familiar to our next guest. Doreena Connolly is a Cork woman who began her career as an intern in MTV. Since then, she's worked with Apple, TikTok and Sony. And she's now general manager of music label Rhino UK, which is part of the Warner Music Group. We'll get to some of those stories in a little bit. But first, Doreena, were you interested in music as a kid growing up in Kanturk?
I always was interested in music. Yeah, I definitely grew up in a house where music was being played. We used to fly from Dublin every year for a family holiday. So that required a 4 or 5 hour drive at the time. And there was always music playing. And my mum was a big ABBA fan. And my dad was a big Neil Young fan. And my older sister was a big Prodigy fan. So it definitely...
So there was a bit of a clash. I was going to say, did the folks sort of insist that you listen to their mixtape?
No, actually, not in the car. There was a lot of Alanis Morissette, Jagged Little Pill, music for the Jolted Generation by The Prodigy, a lot of E17, a lot of boy bands, given the age that we were at the time.
It's okay, you don't have to apologise for it.
It's the natural instinct to apologise for it, but also very proud of the music that we all grew up listening to and has definitely helped me in my career today, actually.
So when you were in school, did you have any idea what you wanted to do? Did you think about the music business in any way?
Well, funnily enough, actually, I really wanted to work for RTE for a very long time. I had my heart set as when I was about 7 years old, I think I wanted to work for RTE and I wanted to be a newsreader.
But it's never too late.
A career in journalism wasn't quite for me, but I think I actually did work experience in transition year for RTE in Cork and was working on the No Disco show with Uneen Fitzsimons and Rory Cobb, who was producing it at the time. And it was actually, that was the real turning point of me realising that there was a business behind this. And I started kind of learning a bit more about that business and learning a bit more about record labels and management and how that worked.
And then an opportunity came up with MTV. How did that happen?
So I'd just finished my uni degree in Cork, in CIT in Cork, and I did my J1 summer over in Boston and had a wonderful time and then came back and realised quite quickly it was time to get out there and try and find some opportunities and try and find a job, really. So I was working in an internet cafe on Oliver Plunkett Street in Cork and had all day every day to be sat in front of a computer. So I started firing off applications and very much had in my mind that I was in Cork then, but I would travel to wherever would give me a job. And I was applying for roles in the US, which was obviously, you know, not going to be very easy from a visa standpoint, but entry level kind of internships, and a few in Germany, in France, a few in Dublin and Belfast, and then London. I saw this opportunity at MTV in Camden in London for a talent and music intern, and read the job description and was like, this is absolutely fully up my street, and sent off the application.
Were you nervous going into that, or did you feel you were the best candidate for the job, or somebody who maybe was going to have to flam up a little bit of what you might have done, as many of us do in a job interview?
Yeah, I think I felt reasonably confident. The only thing that actually kind of rocked me a little bit was that it was one of my first actually proper like job interviews, and I wore a business suit and realized going into the interview when I was surrounded by people very casually dressed and very coolly dressed in band t-shirts, etc., that I'd very much overestimated what I would wear.
They all wore suits to their interviews. You see, they wear the t-shirts because they have the job.
That is very true. It's better to be overdressed than underdressed, which is what I was telling myself when I left. But I think I felt reasonably like I had a shot at it, because when I was in uni, I did a lot in terms of what was my own interests, for sure. When I was working in a bar in Cork, the owners of the bar, I approached them and said, I've got this idea for a club night. Would you let me like book some DJs and sell some tickets? And they were, you know, very generously allowed me to do that. So I had some experience in club promotions. I was also the PR officer for the LGBTQ society in Cork in uni. So that gave me kind of a bit of PR exposure. And
it's interesting, as you say, all of those things that you've done, that when you find yourself in London in a job interview with MTV, all of these interests, all these different things that you've done can kind of come together and really get you over the line.
Absolutely. And it absolutely did.
Was it a big moment for you when you found out then you'd got the job?
Oh, yeah, absolutely huge. I remember it. I remember it so clearly because I think about a week had elapsed from my interview. And I was in Cork, in my bedroom in Cork, and I was about to go out to work at the Internet Cafe. And I was really quite disappointed because I just figured that I hadn't gotten it because I hadn't heard anything and was trying to like console myself and think about what the next move would be. And then like magic, the phone rang and it was a guy called David Moggendorf, who is a very trusted colleague and very trusted friend and has been for a long time. But he was the guy that gave me the call in MTV 19 years ago and said, yeah, we loved your interview. Do you fancy coming and starting over here? And one of the first phone calls I made was obviously to my firstly to my mum and then to my dad, who was a secondary school teacher at St. Mary's in Mallow at the time. And I never called him at work, but I called him at work and I got the school secretary to pull him out of class for the first and last time so I could give him the news that I'd gotten the job. So huge, yeah, huge news.
So then it was off to London. London awaited, beckoned, and you went. Did you fall in love with the place, the big city, straight away?
The second that I arrived in London, I knew I was not going to be leaving. I had a real sense of belonging and a real sense of this is where I needed to be. And that, of course, caused its own complications. You know, it's not easy moving to a big city on your own and making that life for yourself. And was quite, you know, torn at times where I was like, I really feel like I need to be here and I've got an amazing job and a career prospect here. But it's hard also when you're that young and you're away from home and your family and your friends. And it takes real determination, I think, to stick that part out.
One of the exciting things as well about going to a big city from a rural community in Cork in Ireland is that sense of more openness, of exploration, of many, many different kinds of people. Growing up as a gay woman, did you find that there was anything stifling or restrictive about where you were from and that maybe London gave you a bit more freedom or confidence around that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I didn't come out to anybody until a few days after my leaving cert had finished in Kenturk because I knew I needed to be out of the system of education, secondary school education before I moved to Cork to go to uni. And I needed to feel that sense of freedom that should anything feel uncomfortable or should I, you know, suffer any ill from coming out to anybody, that at least I had a bit more freedom and I wasn't kind of stuck in a classroom, etc. So that was very important to me, to make sure that I had some sense of freedom before I actually was more open about that. But moving to London, and there was a certain amount of freedom in Cork for sure, but yeah, of course, growing up in rural Ireland, when you don't really have much of any kind of access to anybody who is like you or any kind of role models, etc. There was dial-up internet at the time when I was 15 or 16, which gave me some kind of outlet to talk to people like me who are going through kind of similar things. But yes, of course, it was.
It could be a lonely place to be.
Yeah, and it was at times for sure. And I think I definitely had my eye on making the big move. And I think I always had in the back of my mind that I would be happier and more free in a big city for sure.
But you also sound like you had a plan about it in terms of keeping it a secret for a load of worked out reasons that you had worked out, you know, and then you decided once I finish school and I go to Cork, then that's when I'm going to come out. You sort of worked it all out in your head.
Yeah, very much so. I've known about my sexuality since I was very young, since I was about five. and worked through that quite alone, really, because that's, you know, I think it's a similar experience for a lot of people like me, you know, until you have yourself worked out, you don't really know how to talk, and you're also very young, you don't know how to share that with people. And it was very much, you know, the 90s rural Ireland, it was not a conversation that I was ready and able to have at that time. So it did take time, and I knew that I needed to be in a bigger place. I needed to have more freedom, and I think grow my own community and have that community support as well before I was, you know, able to be fully out, I think.
So you find yourself, you're in London, it's MTV. Is the business as glamorous as it appeared from the outside?
I'd say actually for a lot of it, probably yes. It was the real glory days of MTV as it was in 2006. And they had definitely transitioned from being a pure kind of very much music focused broadcaster. They had started doing kind of a lot of the reality TV shows that they were doing, which was a real turning point. There was Pimp My Ride, there was The Hills, etc. But it was still very much music and celebrity focused. And a big part of my role, the main part of my role as the intern, was to accompany all of the talent that would come through the doors in MTV to do their various interviews and go to various studios, and I needed to ferry them around the building and make sure they were in the right place at the right time.
So did you find yourself looking after any big stars early on? Were you a bit starstruck?
I don't think I was ever really quite starstruck. I just had such a brilliant time. I never remember feeling, oh my God, there's like... Of course, I had the appropriate reverence for the people that I was meeting, but I never felt starstruck. I just thought, what an absolute privilege that I'm even doing this.
So who did you meet?
I used to keep a list actually on my Bebo page of the people that I had met, because there was just so many every day. But the highlights were definitely on the first day I met Craig David, who was an enormous star. At the time, there was Charlotte Church, there was Pink, there was Tom Cruise, Jamie Foxx, Justin Timberlake, Cameron Diaz, Madonna.
Oh, they were all there. And that sense of looking after them, was that difficult? You know, would they have a lot of riders and various things that they wanted, unusual things?
Sometimes, yes, but for the most part, no. And I know everybody wants to hear about the really difficult, you know, the really difficult experiences and the really rude and difficult artists, etc. But honest to God, the very, very vast majority, I'd say 99.9% of the time, everybody that I met was absolutely charming and lovely. And of course, you know, they're there to do a job, and sometimes there's some stress involved, or, you know, they don't want to answer a question, or they don't want to do something, or they cancel an interview at the last minute. But it was always very much for me just kind of seeing the human side of it. It's like, well, they're tired, they don't want to do that, and that's okay, you know, we'll manage that. And I can very much say that nobody, bar one artist, who I won't actually name, was very rude to me at one point. I had to sit out in the rain in Camden in the parking lot in MTV and wait for their cab because they didn't want to wait outside in the rain. But that person shall remain nameless.
But you remember.
I remember, and I will never forget. But I will.
Nobody looking for any sort of I don't know, non-organic honey and metal teaspoons only, or I don't know, pink dyed kittens.
No, never had that. No, the biggest thing actually in 2006 when it came to riders was Fiji water. Fiji water was on every rider, and in London at the time, it was incredibly difficult to get. I think there was one store, or maybe, you know, one or two stores in the vicinity of MTV, and they kept selling out of Fiji water. So that was the biggest stress, I think.
And
it was
a particular brand, and it was from Fiji, was it?
Yes, yeah. You'd see it quite, it's more common now, I think. You'd see it more often in stores and stuff, but there was very strict riders, no Evian, no other generic brand bottled water. Had to be Fiji water. So that was the biggest stress.
But I must try that the next time I'm ordering some water somewhere. Is it? Have you got Fiji? It's not Fiji.
It does actually taste different, and I can appreciate why people actually wanted that more than other water.
You've drank the Kool-Aid there,
Jordan. I have, yeah. I've been in London too long when I can appreciate different bottled water, for sure.
And you went on then with the music industry. You worked with Apple Music. You worked to run label partnerships at TikTok. And that's one of the things. Were there particular stars who were early adapters to TikTok and saw its potential early on and presumably have benefited enormously from that?
Yeah, for sure. There was actually more in the probably American artists, like Lil Nas X was absolutely huge on TikTok because he adopted it so early. Ed Sheeran was actually quite an early adopter of TikTok as well. And you can see that in certain artists, kind of their follower count and the footprint that they have made since 2020 now, because they were very early adopters of things like TikTok. And short form video was not new in the music space. There was Vine was around for a while, but never really made much of an impact. I don't think it was really licensed for music anyway. That wasn't its intention. But when TikTok came about and it's, you know, it had music licenses, you could make short form video with a whole music library full of tracks. And starting to see that impact of TikTok when I was at Apple Music, that was particularly interesting because it was always a challenge and had been a challenge for the industry for a long time as to how do you break new artists? Is it radio? Is it TV? Is it, you know, social media as it was then? But it was never particularly clear. And then TikTok comes along and you could very much see the impact of the artists that were using TikTok to great effect.
What about social media then for you with the older artists, the classics, the back catalogue? Is it about trying to introduce them and using social media to introduce them to this older music? Is it about maybe capitalising? A good example would be like the Kate Bush song Running Up That Hill featured in the Stranger Things series, and all of a sudden it opened up Kate Bush to a whole other audience. What's the goal for you, or how do you use it to introduce that music to a new audience?
So even when I was at TikTok before I came to Rhino, I used to regularly meet with Rhino as the TikTok label head and with other catalogue labels, and really try to impress on them the importance of engaging their artists in this new technology. And of course, being sensitive to the fact that there are certainly some artists very much that Rhino work with that are, you know, the estates that we work with, artists that are no longer with us. David Bowie, for instance. David Bowie and his estate and the label were very early adopters actually of TikTok. And having everybody who can make that difference understand that it's TikTok, social media, gaming, Netflix, etc. Those avenues are where your new audience is. Yes, it's where younger generations are, but it's also, you know, people who love music and listen to music, and they're all potential streamers and consumers of that music. So what we need to do is to make sure that we're kind of in it to win it, is probably how I would sum it up. We need to be putting our music in these places that people are ready and happy to consume it.
And it's a huge industry, isn't it? Because the whole question of buying back catalogues, a lot of companies like Warner Music have been in the content music industry, etc., for a very long time. But even private equity firms like Blackstone have bought, and some Pink Floyd sold their back catalogue for $400 million. And I suppose from a business point of view, you ask the question, how will they get all that money back? You know, it must be a long haul in order to get all of that back.
I mean, I've never quite worked on that side of the business. But yeah, of course, that is the intention. You know, when you're an entity that buys a back catalogue, you buy it because you ultimately hope that you will make a profit from it.
And a real plus, I'd imagine, would be, for example, somebody using one of your songs that Rhino has the rights to and owns in a film or in a Netflix series, which becomes a big hit. Is it quite random, the person who chooses that piece of music? Is it random because this is a piece of music that they always liked, they really liked it? How can you feed into that process and say, here, have a look at this, why don't you use this?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So we have a very active and very successful and very wonderful sync team at Warner Music. And their role is exactly that, which is to liaise with the Netflixes of this world and various advertising agencies, etc., and to be able to sell in the music that we have. Describe how fantastic a piece of our music would be for this particular ad. And sometimes they are, or you know, a scene in a movie or in a TV show, they're given briefs as to X entity is looking for a track that fits the following criteria. And then the sync team do their best work to try and get our repertoire in there.
Do you get back to Kanturk much these days?
Probably maybe about twice a year at the minute. We have myself and my partner have a now 12-week-old baby. Travelling is a little bit challenging. We are planning on coming home for Christmas, but we're trying to encourage family to come over the other way as well, which of course they have been doing, which has been wonderful. So not making it home as much now, but yeah, the intentions are there, but a bit challenging with a little one.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Doreena Connolly, General Manager of Rhino UK. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you very much.